We had never seen this gentleman, but a relative of his, who knew of our work, asked us to concentrate for him at our next psychic circle. We did so and a spirit was brought who controlled Mrs. Wickland. After some solicitation she gave her full name, confessing that she had been the first wife of Mr. Me, and she then told her story. She had met Mr. Me in Chicago during the World's Fair and, for a time, they had lived together without the formality of marriage until his relatives discovered the situation and compelled them to marry. The girl was accepted in society but rebelled at the restraints of conventional life, and, being of a vain and restless disposition, could not live happily with her husband. She finally left him and went to the West Side, where she entered a house of ill repute. Although at times she regretted the folly of her conduct, she continued her mode of living, became a morphine addict and finally committed suicide. After her death she had returned to her husband, and when he married again she felt angrily aggrieved, and at last influenced him to leave his wife and child, to go to quarters where she herself felt more at home. We convinced her of the great wrong she was doing in controlling her former husband in this manner, and after she had obtained an understanding of the progress awaiting her in the spirit world, she promised to leave, wishing to attain a higher condition. When next we saw the relative of Mr. Me, who had asked us to concentrate for him, we told her of the story related by the spirit, and in amazement she admitted it was true in every detail, that the name given was correct and that Mr. Me had been married before, but that the unfortunate episode had been regarded by the family as a skeleton in the closet and was never mentioned. She later reported that Mr. Me had returned to his home, normal and sane, and was again living happily with his wife and child. Chapter 6, Spirits and Crime. Habits, desires and inclinations are rooted in the mind and remain with the individual after he is freed from his physical body, until they are eliminated by the will. The spirits of many criminals, murderers, those who were executed or are seeking for revenge, remain indefinitely in the earth sphere and often endeavor to continue their former activities and to carry out their evil designs through controlling the bodies of mortals who are sensitive to their influence. In many cases of revolting murder, investigations will show that the crimes were committed by innocent persons under the control of disembodied spirits who had taken complete possession of the murderer. There is little doubt that the murder of Stanford White by Harry K. Thaw in 1906, at Madison Square Roof Garden, New York, was due to spirit influence. Harry Thaw was a psychic sensitive and had shown evidence of this fact all his life. And whatever personal grievances he may have had when he killed Stanford White, he was unquestionably obsessed by avenging spirits who desired retribution for real or fancied injustice done to themselves or kindred. Harry Thaw was largely only the psychic subject and the physical instrument through which was enacted a terrible drama by the invisible world, the actors being ignorant, revengeful spirits. On July 15, 1906, several weeks after the tragedy occurred, a strange spirit controlled Mrs. Wickland during a psychic circle and fell prostrate to the floor. Placing the form of my wife in a chair, I began questioning the controlling intelligence. The stranger strenuously objected to being touched, brusquely demanded to be left alone, and called out, "Hey there, waiter. Bring me a drink." "What kind of drink do you want?" "Bring me a whiskey and soda, and be quick about it." "Who are you?" "None of your business who I am." "Where do you think you are?" "In Madison Square Roof Garden."
"Of course."
"What is your name?"
"Stanford White."
Holding one hand on the back of his head, on the right side, and clutching at his chest and abdomen as if in great pain, he cried, "Have a waiter bring me that whiskey and soda." I was about to ask further questions when the spirit's attention was attracted to some invisible, and he began to tremble with fear.
"Are you seeing dead people?"
He nodded his head violently, then shouted, "They are after me." And, jumping from the chair, ran to a corner of the room in an effort to escape. His agitation was so great that he lost control of the psychic and was gone. Immediately another spirit took possession of the psychic and in great excitement began to walk back and forth, exclaiming exultantly, "I kill the dog! I kill the dog! There he lies!
pointing at the floor toward the spot where White had lost control. The dog. I have been looking for a chance to kill him for several years, and I got him at last. The dog. I forced the spirit to sit down and learned that his name was Johnson. I killed Stanford White, he boasted. He deserved death. He had trifled too long with our daughters. He was very pronounced in his denunciation of society men. They steal our children from us and put fine clothes on them, and the parents do not know what becomes of them. I asked the spirit whether he was aware of being dead, but he laughed at the idea and said, "How could a dead person talk?" The doctor said I had consumption and would die soon, but I didn't die. I never felt better in my life. When asked to carefully examine his hands, feet and dress, he demanded to know how he, a man, became possessed of a woman's body. Lengthy argument finally convinced the perplexed spirit of the fact of his transition, and he departed, thoroughly penitent. He was followed by a third entity, but this intelligence was aware of being a spirit, temporarily controlling a borrowed body. I am Harry Thor's father. Save my boy, save my boy. He is not guilty. Harry will not be electrocuted. Later events proved this to be true. He is sensitive to spirit influence and has been all his life. He was always erratic and so excitable that we were afraid to correct him for fear he would become insane. But I see our mistake now. I did not understand the cause of Harry's queer actions while I was in the physical, but now, from the spirit side of life, I can see that Harry has been a tool in the hands of selfish, earthbound spirits most of his life. He was obsessed by revengeful spirits when he killed Stanford White. I have tried to reach the external world by every possible avenue, to tell the people that Harry is not insane, but that he is a psychic sensitive. Save my boy. Save my boy, he begged repeatedly. What would you have us do? Please write to my wife, and to my attorney, Mr. Olcott. We did not then know that Mr. Olcott had been Mr. Thor's attorney, but verified the fact afterward. Tell them your experience and what I have said to you, and urge them to recognize and understand Harry's condition. We promised to comply with the wish of the spirit and he then departed. The following evening, July 16th, another spirit came. He seemed at first to be looking for someone, then asked, where did the other fellows go? This spirit also condemned high society in general, and denounced young girls in particular for their foolishness. The rich take our girls to their dens, they put them on the stage and the girls disown their parents. They deserve licking. He declared, and emphasized his words with suitable gestures. This spirit was laboring under such great mental excitement that he suddenly lost control before I could ascertain any particulars. On February 10, 1907, the spirit of Mr. Thor returned, and reiterated his statement that Harry was a psychic sensitive who was frequently subject to the influence of mischievous spirits. He also urged upon humanity the great need for inquiry into the subject of spirit influence, saying that a proper understanding would prevent untold misery to both spirits and their unfortunate mortal victims. That Richard Evans, hung for the murder of Mrs. Bessie Hollister in Chicago, 1906, was a victim of foreign influences was so evident that alienists, criminologists and psychologists alike declared their belief that Evans was innocent, and that he had confessed the crime under the hypnotic suggestion of some unknown person. Evans would alternately confess his guilt, saying, with a strange, trance-like stare, that a big man had compelled him to commit the deed, and then again wildly deny it. Hugo Munsterberg, M.D., professor of psychology, Harvard University, wrote in June, 1906, "It is an interesting and yet rather clear case of dissociation and autosuggestion. The witches of the 17th century were burned on account of similar confessions, and the popular understanding of mental aberrations has not made much progress since that time." Professor William James of Harvard wrote, "Whether guilty or not, Evans must have been in a state of dissociated personality. He was not his natural self during those fateful first days, but the victim of one of those rare alterations of personality either suggested or spontaneous, which are now well known to occur in predisposed subjects. We present a sequel to this tragic story. Experience, March 7, 1907. Spirit, Richard Evans. Psychic, Mrs. Wickland. When the spirit assumed control, the psychic fell to the floor apparently lifeless, and only after half an hour of strenuous effort was the intelligence brought to consciousness. "Leave me alone," he moaned. "Do you want to hang me again?" He complained of having great pain in the neck and begged to be left undisturbed, saying he wanted only to sleep. "What is the trouble with your neck?" "It is broken. They hanged me and I am dead. I want to remain dead. If you bring me to life, they will hang me again." "What is your name?"
"Richard Evans."
"Were you guilty of the murder of Mrs. Hollister?"
"I do not know. Others said I was. If I did it, I do not know it."
"Why did you plead guilty at times and then again deny your confession?"
"I pleaded guilty because those three fellows, spirits, made me. The big man stood over me with a knife and threatened to kill me if I would not plead guilty. When the big man was not there, I told them that I did not know whether I killed the lady or not. I told it to the police, I told it to the jailer and to everybody that questioned me, but they would not believe me when I told them the truth. 0 hours, I have suffered so much. Why did you call me back when I was dead? Why didn't you let me sleep? They will arrest me and hang me again."
Suddenly the spirit shouted with fright, "Don't you see? There is that big man again. He has his knife and the two short fellows are with him. Oh!" Clutching his knee, he cried, "My knee. He has driven the knife through my knee and through the other leg. My leg. My leg. He is the devil. He has stabbed me." The terrified spirit was gradually made to understand that his tormentors were spirits, that he was free from his physical body and beyond the power of bodily harm. "You are using a body not your own and need now to free yourself from all mental delusions. Do you not see other spirits beside your enemies?"
"Why, yes, there are others now. They seem to be friendly, and there there's Mrs. Hollister."
"Ask the man with the knife why he hounds you," I suggested. "He only grins. Ask him why he wanted to kill the lady.
He says, because he hates women." He stopped abruptly, and, breathless, seemed to be watching a scene of great disturbance.
"They have taken those devils away. It was a lively fight, but they got them." Calming himself, he said, "I feel better now. I am so glad that terrible man is gone." Asked to recall what he could of the Hollister tragedy, he said, "When I saw the woman that night, I also saw the big man. My head began to feel very strange. I was grabbed by the throat and lost consciousness. When I came to myself again, the big man said that I had killed the woman. I had known the man for about a month, but I did not know he was a spirit. He has been hounding me ever since. Why didn't they give me a chance to live, even if I would have been in prison? Oh, the shame I have brought upon my family. I feel so sorry for my poor mother. If she could only know the truth. If I could only speak to her and tell her that I could not help it, that I did not do it. Nobody had any sympathy for me, and nobody would believe me when I told them about the big fellow standing over me with the knife. He made me plead guilty. If I committed the crime, I am sorry for it, but I don't know that I have done it. Why did they kill me?" After I had explained the continuity of life and progression into higher spiritual realms, he eagerly asked, "If they did not kill me, is the lady still alive also?"
"Certainly. Doubtless she has come here to forgive you. Although you destroyed her physical body, you were not responsible for the act. You were merely used by wicked spirits who hypnotized you." With this new understanding, the weary spirit was taken in charge by invisible helpers, who told us that the big man and his accomplices had in earth life belonged to a band of white caps which had operated extensively for some years in England and America, mutilating and killing many women in their criminal mania. Several months later, the spirit of the big man himself was brought to our circle. Experience, June 6, 1907. Spirit, Charles the Fighter. Psychic, Mrs. Wickland. The spirit seemed stupefied by drink, and when finally aroused was so pugnacious that the aid of several persons was required to quiet him. "I'm Charles the Fighter, and I'll have you all shot. he shouted. Turning to some other invisibles, he cursed them for having lured him to this place and commanded them to help him, instead of standing idly by. Subdued at last, Charles the Fighter was compelled to listen to an elucidation of his real situation. In an endeavor to convince him that he was controlling the body of another, he was asked to examine the hands of the psychic. Seeing the hand of a woman, he shrank back, terror-stricken, and cried, "Take that hand away. Take it away. I don't want to see it anymore." Questioned regarding the story of the hand, he declared, "I shall never tell. I would rather die. Oh, there is her face too. And the hand that I cut off to get the diamond ring. They haunted me all this time." Looking about in horror, he seems to see a vast gathering of specters. "See all those faces. Have I killed all those people? Have they come to accuse me? There. There is that boy. He was hung once, but he seems to be after me too. Evans, I killed the woman, but I made him confess to save my own neck. But just wait, you devil, you. I will fix you when I get out of this. I will cut you all to pieces." But at last Charles the Fighter realized that further resistance was useless and that his days of robbery and murder were over. He told of his hideous career of crime and said that he murdered for revenge, stole to buy whiskey, and drank to drown his conscience and to escape the specters which constantly haunted him. In early childhood he had been happy under the care of his own mother, but after her death his stepmother had abused him so mercilessly that he often rushed sobbing to his room and, on his knees, prayed to his dead mother for help. This roused the stepmother to a jealous fury and, regardless of the protests of a weak father, she had beaten him angrily, forbidding him to ever mention the name of his mother again. Her abuse grew into such a cruel tyranny that the boy had developed an overpowering hatred for her and revengefully vowed that when he was grown he would kill every woman possible. Consistently he had carried out his ghastly purpose and had given his entire life to plotting and perpetrating atrocities and crimes, generally victimizing women. Eel had died in 1870, during a wild fight with his companions, but he had not been aware of the loss of his physical body. He boasted that for many years he had continued his crimes, always eluding the police. "Once, in Boston, I wanted to kill a policeman, but when I sneaked up behind him and hit him on the head with a club, the club went right through him and never hurt him. He didn't even turn around." The spirit thought himself now in the hands of authorities but declared that he was willing to give himself up to escape the haunting faces of his many victims. "I would be glad to go to Bell to get away from this torment." While listening to an explanation of the law of cause and effect and the conditions prevailing in the spirit world, Charles saw his own mother standing before him. The sight of her had an overwhelming effect. The hardened criminal cowered in his seat and wept piteously while his mother pleaded with him to come with her and learn to expiate his crimes. "I crushed by guilt and remorse," he cried abjectly, "I cannot go with you. Dear mother, don't ask me to go with you. You must go back to heaven and I must go to hell, where I belong. I must be cut to pieces and burned in the fires of hell." But maternal love prevailed and the spirit, humble and penitent, followed his mother. In 1894 Harry Hayward, a handsome reprobate with a weakness for beautiful women and a life of gaiety, hired a villain to murder his sweetheart in Minnesota and was hanged. While he was in prison awaiting execution he maintained his debonair attitude to the last, played cards with his jailer with the utmost nonchalance, and ordered ice cream, his favorite dish, whenever possible. "When you come to hell, where I am going," he told the jailer, "I am going to treat you to ice cream." During this time I anonymously sent him a book and several papers relating to the spirit world, but otherwise had no connection with him. On February 27, 1908, a nurse asked us to concentrate for Mrs. McCaw, a patient whom she was attending, Arad whose case strongly suggested psychic invalidism, chronic illness and lassitude due to spirit obsession. The nurse was a psychic sensitive herself and surmised that many of the uncontrollable notions of her beautiful patient were caused by spirit obsession, and had several times endeavored to order any intruder away. One day Mrs. McCaw developed an intense desire for homemade ice cream, although ordinarily she did not care in the least for it. But she insisted that her whim be satisfied at once, putting her maids to a great deal of inconvenience. When the nurse entered the room with the ice cream, she had a sudden feeling that someone had rushed upon her, and the next instant was seized by so strong a feeling of choking that she was forced to leave the room. Upon recovery, she returned and, convinced of the presence of a spirit, flung a window open and silently ordered any foreign entity present to leave the house. This nurse and Mrs. McCaw's maid attended our circle that evening, and the controlling spirit at once complained of pain in, see chap. 9, page 206. Spirit, Grace Brusted, patient, Mrs. MCA. The neck, readily explaining that his neck had been broken when Neil was hung, and said his name was Harry Haywood. Can't you give me some ice cream? I have tried and tried to get some, and today I could almost taste it, but I couldn't quite get it. I was chased away by a woman, she threw me out of the window. I don't like to be thrown out of a window by a woman. Haywood realized that he was hovering around the earth as a spirit, and when we inquired how he had learned about spirit life, he replied that while he was in jail he had read of it in some literature which had been sent him by an unknown person. He complained that no matter where he went no one would take any notice of him. When he took a seat in a train someone would come along and sit down on his lap, and he would be powerless to move. He was very pleased to be able to converse with people again and asked many questions about the various persons concerned with his trial and execution, inquiring particularly about the guard with whom he had spent a great deal of time playing cards. I was under the impression that this guard had died some time before and informed the spirit so, suggesting that possibly he might be able to see him in the spirit world. He was silent a moment, endeavoring to trace his former friend, then said emphatically, "No, that man is not dead. I see him playing cards at his son's home in Minneapolis." Haywood was readily enlightened concerning the higher life and left, expressing a willingness to progress in the spirit world. The psychic invalid showed marked changes for the better after this, and subsequent correspondence proved Haywood's statement about the old guard to be true. The latter was living, and on the evening of our experience with Haywood had been playing cards in his son's home. 10 years later, after the spirit of another murderer, who was hung, had been in our circle, Haywood returned and told something of his earth life. Experience, September 21, 1918. Spirit, Harry Haywood. Psychic, Mrs. Wickland. I think I should like to come in and say something, for I feel I have been in the same boat as the fellow who preceded me, I mean, on the same platform. I feel but little better than he. I had a little more understanding than he had, and therefore my punishment was a little harder. I had education and all the money I needed, but I wanted more. I also want to tell you that since I have come to the spirit side of life I have wished I could go on every street corner and shout a message to mothers not to raise their children in the wrong way. Mothers say they love their children, they worship them, and they let them go astray because they cannot say no to them. Do not raise children without discipline. Train children as you train animals, as you train flowers. If you plant a flower in your garden you don't want it to grow up wild, but you train it so that it will grow successfully, and have graceful flowers. But how little does humanity think of the children's growth and training? Children are not trained to become blossoms for humanity. I tell you, if my mother, I do not condemn her by any means, had trained me properly, so that she could have said no to me, instead of worshipping me and letting me have all the money I wanted, and if she had punished me when I did wrong, I would have been different. No, I would not have been hung if my mother had taught me the beautiful lesson of living for others, and of loving my fellow man as myself. If mothers would think of their children's welfare and raise them in the beautiful thought of living for others, they would all be better. I lived a very sporty life. Nobody taught me any other. I had a very good time and I liked the girls pretty well, but there came a time when I spent more money than my father allowed me to have. I was only a young man and I should have been made to work. My misfortune was that my mother and father were rich. Work was a disgrace for me, they thought. It would have been far better if they had put me to work instead of giving me money each time I asked for it. I commenced to gamble. You know, when you get into that game, it is hard to quit. Money came too easy for me. I met a young lady whom I liked. Young girls always were sweet to me, and I was able to have whoever I wanted. The young lady liked me, and I liked her for what I got from her, so we decided that she would insure herself for $10,000 in my name. I had a scheme. If somebody killed her, I would not get the blame, but I would get the money. I laid a bold scheme. I hired a man to kill her. At the time the deed was to be committed, I took another girl to the theater, because I thought that, whatever happened, blame could not then be attached to me. I hired a man to take her for a buggy ride out to Lake Calhoun, and he was to kill her. When they got to the woods, the man killed her, and came home. Being in the theater, the girl I was with could testify I was not at the scene of the killing, but, you know, I was so crazy to get hold of the insurance money that I never thought how it looked to go to the insurance office so soon after the death, and they became suspicious, and finally caught me. If I had only waited a week or two, they would never have surmised anything about me. I was arrested. My mother loved me so much that she tried to put the blame on my other brother. He was married and had two children. The trial cost my parents a whole lot of money, and lasted months and months before they could make any headway. They could not decide whether it was Eddie or I that should be hung for the deed. One day, while I was in jail, there came a little pamphlet for me, and some papers, all about the spirit world. I knew I had to go, for finally I had been sentenced to be hung. I realized my trouble. The papers interested me very much, and I thought I should like to know what the spirit world was. I believed in it in a way, and in another way, I didn't. The doctrine was better than the church had taught, but for a while I treated it more as a joke. I talked about it quite a little to the watchman, but when the time came for me to be hung, I shrank from it. It is a very strange sensation when you think you are going to the gallows and your life will be snapped out. You cannot imagine how it feels. You cannot imagine the sensation you have when you realize that you have only a few hours to live. Still, the little message which had been sent to me gave me a little courage, and I thought probably only my body would be destroyed and not my spirit. So at the last moment I kept up my courage and felt that I wanted to see what the hereafter was. I have to thank the one who sent me that pamphlet, because it was a bright, cheerful spot to me at the last of my days. When I realized that I had passed out of my body, my first thought was, I am not dead. I went to my mother, and I spoke to her, and she felt my presence. I still clung to my body, however, and I felt I could not leave it. I got out of it quickly, but I went back to it again. When my body was cremated, I stood by and saw it burned. After that I walked around, but I could not find the spirit world. I walked and walked, from one place to another. I still had my feeling for nice pretty women, so I traveled. In a way, I realized that I was dead, yet I did not fully realize it. One time I felt I would like to take a journey and I wanted to travel by train. I went to the ticket office to get a ticket, but I had no money. I thought I would talk to the agent nicely and he would give me a ticket, but he paid no attention to me. So I thought, all right, I'm going on the train anyway, so on I got. I sat down on one of the seats, and, before I knew it, a great, big, fat man sat right down on my lap. I got real mad. I tried to push him off, but I could not, and I could not get up either. I had to let that man sit on me until he was ready to get off the train. I had not learned the power of thought, to think myself away. I had only learned to walk. I had not yet learned the little thought lesson to think myself in a place in order to be there. Before long I came to a beautiful lady, Mrs. McCaw, and I commenced to like her. Before I knew it, I was in her magnetic aura and I could not get away. She wanted to be in bed all the time, and there I was. Once I heard someone say, "You must leave this lady and go away. If there is any spirit around her, it must leave and go away." I was there, however, I was very fond of ice cream, and I wanted some, so I impressed the lady to ask for it. When it was brought in, I wanted it. I seemed to come in contact with the lady who was carrying it, and I felt that if I could only get a good hold of her, I would get the cream.